This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Well, I would like to welcome to the podcast PGA Tour winner, European Tour winner, and Ryder Cup member Jesper Parnevik to the Sub 70 podcast. Jesper, thanks for taking the time today to be on the show. Appreciate it.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
So how's your golf game currently right now? You kind of have the last part of the season on the Champions Tour. The stats look pretty solid. Anything you're working on, excited about? How are you feeling about the last kind of push here for the 2018 season?
Golf is such a weird game, so you never know how you're going to play. But my game has felt pretty good the last few weeks. I felt very good in Calgary, and I almost finished last there. So, like I said, you never know. It all comes down to, short game putting, momentum, and all those stuff that's hard control. But the game feels pretty good. My putting's been a little bit iffy all year. But even that one feels like it's on the right track.
How much are you enjoying your time on the Champions Tour? You played the other major tours for a long period of time. You played the European Tour. You played the PGA Tour for years. How are you enjoying the vibe out on the Champions Tour and the competition that's there?
Put it this way. I think it's the best tour on the planet, period. It's and when I was about to come out on the Champions Tour, all the players told me, yeah, you're going to enjoy it. You're going to have a great time, blah, blah. You're not going to play any other tour. But it seems like most guys come out on the Champions Tour and they are going to keep playing on the PGA Tour or European Tour or do a little bit of both. And once you get out there and you see how much fun it is, you meet all your old friends again. It's fantastic, I would say. It's called Champions Tour because, all the guys up there have won. They're legends. They have had great careers. They're now enjoying themselves, but they're also very competitive since they are the legends they are. It's not like they're just going to go stroll around and take everything, do everything half-assed. Bernhard Langer, practices harder than he ever has in his whole career. This guy is pretty impressive. He's out there, I would say, almost 10, 12 hours a day, which is amazing.
Well, that's what I noticed when I talked to you out at the Players' Championship out at Exmoor. I was there early, and when I left late in the afternoon, you guys were still out practicing and putting the time in on a Tuesday. So it's no joke of the effort and the practice that you guys are still doing.
No, I would say, like I said, everybody that's out there and have had the careers they've had, they also had them because of they hate losing and they hate playing bad golf. So, everybody's still putting the time in, and the scores are low. Everybody's playing well. If you don't shoot 15, 20 under for three rounds, you pretty much have no chance to win the tournament, and that's pretty low, I think.
So you've won on the Champions Tour. You won 2016 at the Insperity. You've had a chance to play in all of the Champions Tour majors that they have out there. Is there one of the Champions Tour majors you would like to win the most, and how important would it be to grab any major at this point in career on the Champions Tour? Would it, where's your level of importance?
They're all good. I really enjoyed, St. Andrews, British Open St. Andrews this year. Of course, that was fantastic because of the history behind St. Andrews and all that. But we played great courses, even, the U.S. Opens and the seniors, and most of the PGA would, and then you have the one we play in Alabama. They're all good tournaments, so I would not be picky for that way which one of the majors I would win. I would take anyone, and it would definitely count as a major if someone asked me as well.
As you're gotten into your 50s, is there parts of your golf game that's actually better than it was, say, at 35? And then is there a flip side that there are parts that as you've, gotten older, hit 9 million golf balls, that's not as sharp as it used to be 20 years ago, say?
Well, when you say sharp, that's pretty much the biggest difference I would notice. I'm not as sharp as I was when I was 20, 20, 25 there, when you woke up in the morning, all you were thinking about was golf. Golf was everything, that was the only thing on your mind pretty much. Then you have pretty much the peak of career, and then you have the kids, families, that whole other side starts growing. And so I would say the focus disappears a little bit. But then there are other parts. I don't know if it's equipment. Of course, it's equipment as well. But I'm probably driving it longer and straighter than I ever have. And hitting my long irons longer. I was never been a good long iron player. But that's better in my game. Putting is probably not as good as it used to be. I mean, I've actually watched some old Ryder Cup tapes. You have reruns right now on the Golf Channel because of Ryder Cup. And I could just tell how confident I was in my putting and how, you know, I was focused on making the putts that was there. Now it's a lot of bad thoughts going on in your head. You're thinking what you should do. Take it straight back. Oh, take it straight through. Oh, that felt bad. And then you know. So that's a little bit different than it used to be. I don't remember having that many weird psycho thoughts in my head when I was putting before when I was younger.
And golf will do that to everybody, I think, over the years a little bit. Speaking of equipment, I know you've been with the guys at Cobra Puma for quite a few years now. And when will you as a tour player start putting in new equipment or testing new equipment for the 19 season? When will they start bringing you that stuff? And how does that process work for you of looking at new equipment?
I mean, my experience with Cobra the last few years, that's been pretty easy to get into the new stuff. I remember way back when, you know, when I tried Callaway or Ping or other companies 20 years ago, there was a much bigger process to get fitted right and so on. And, you know, I wouldn't say the quality was maybe as good or the as high technology as today. So well, pretty much when they did come up with a new set and I tried, I pretty much put it in the bag straight away. Same thing with the drivers and wedges. And yeah, so I could practically just put in a new set a week before I started and that would be no problem. Same thing with a driver. And, you know, they have these great 60s and 54 wedges and so on as well that I love.
So that process is not as difficult as it was 20 years ago. They have your specs. They can kind of know which direction it needs to go. The new heads are just a little bit better. You can put it in play relatively quickly compared to what it used to take.
Yeah, and I mean, the biggest difference I've seen since I started with Cobra was actually the spacing in yardage between my clubs. My whole career, I always hit my short irons a long way. I could hit a wedge any distance, it seems like, pretty much, if I wanted to just back foot it and really squeeze it and, you know, hit it a long way. I could move it up and hit it soft. And but that would stop around 6 iron, I would say. I would have about 15 yards between every club. I get to 6 iron and you know, the spacing to the 5 iron will maybe all of a sudden go down to 10 yards, and then the 5 iron to 4 iron will get down to maybe 7 yards, and then the 4 to 3 will go down to maybe 4 yards. And so I never got it over, you know, more than 200, 210 with one of my either 2 iron or 3 iron or whatever. Now it's more of an equal space. So, and of course, it goes further. So now my 6 iron is about 195, my 5 iron is about 210, my 4 iron is about 222. And then I don't need anything after that. I mean, I'm hitting my longer iron, so like a 4 iron. When I hit that about 225, I don't even need a 3 iron. So I put in a 5 wood instead.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, modern technology, right? You're longer now in your 50s with those clubs than you were 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah. That's, I mean, my 4 iron never went over 200 yards my whole career. Now I'm hitting it like 225, which is amazing.
Yeah, between the ball and the clubs, it makes a difference.
Oh, yeah.
Back in Sweden, how did you start playing golf or who introduced you to the game?
Well, it was my dad that got hooked on it. And back then, you know, I was pretty much the only one that played golf in my school or my community or my city and all that. So, and golf was a very new game. It was looked upon as a very rich man's game, if you want to say that. It was not a main game for the main crowd and so on. And then a Swedish hockey player named Sven Tumba came around and he started playing golf, and all of a sudden it became more of every man's game. And my dad got, you know, he was good friends with this guy Sven Tumba, so he got introduced to it. My dad got severely hooked, started building putting greens and bunkers and tees on in our backyard and so on. And so I got introduced to that way, just being curious what my dad was doing all day down there, beating on this weird white ball. And I did not have a great talent for it, I would say. I mean, I was still like a 13 handicap when I was, you know, 26 handicap when I was 13 years old, I think I was. And but I liked the fact that you could practice by yourself and you can practice as much as you wanted. You were not dependent on a team or team hours or so on. So I think that's what made me, you know, escalate so fast when I became around 15, 16, and I was able to put in, you know, the hours needed, and it gave results after a while.
Speaking of your dad, and you know, everyone kind of in golf knows that your dad is extremely famous back in Sweden. And it's an interesting story in the sense of how old were you when you realized, well, first off, how famous is your dad in Sweden? Is it at a insane level that literally he gets recognized everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably on a level that's hard to understand. I mean, when he was on at his peak, you know, his TV show, if you take the Super Bowl ratings are about 35 points. That's a great, you know, rating for any TV channel. And I think his TV show was up there with about an 80 points rating. So
that's crazy.
Everybody in Sweden that was above 2 years old pretty much watched his TV show. And, you know, he toured and so on, but everybody knew who he was. And growing up, I never thought about it that much until actually, you know, you become there. You start going to school and so on, and your friends ask about it. Then you start wondering, well, why are they asking about my dad? I mean, it's just my dad. But then they start realizing that he's actually pretty famous.
Was he funny all the time, or is it business? In other words, or was he naturally funny around the house as a dad growing up? Like that, what was that environment like of essentially being around a comedian all the time?
I mean, I don't think he's spontaneously funny in that sense, like that he goes around cracking jokes all the time. And I would say that with most comedians, you know, they're not on all the time. I mean, they're great, let's say, at big occasions, birthdays, weddings, big parties or so on, and he would go up and have a speech or do a little skit, would be severely funny. He would be spot on great, but it would not, like, he was sitting at our average nighttime dinner table and crack jokes all the time. He was actually more of a thinker, a little bit more quiet, which I also think is the trait of a lot of comedians. They're more introvert than you actually think.
Yeah, I guess where I'm going with it more was he quick? I assume he's not cracking jokes all
the
time.
He's quick, but it's more of a in a professional way. But his act also seemed like he was very quick, very spontaneous. But a lot of it, that's pretty much what I learned is how important it was to practice, rehearse, do your homework and so on, because a lot of his shows, you know, live shows, seemed like he was spot on, spontaneous. Oh, he found the right moment to say certain things, but most of the time was actually rehearsed, and he had pretty much memorized or practiced comments or funny quotes to say in case different situations would turn up.
Yeah, and the talent is to make it look effortless, right?
Exactly. It's like, you know, when people watch us pros play golf, it's, oh, that looks so easy. And you say, no, this is not easy. I mean, you guess how many hours I've been trying to have to work on this?
Exactly. It's still interesting, though. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, he still keeps going. He does a lot of minor shows. I mean, he did a long show a few years ago now. Instead of writing his memoirs, he kind of did a theater show about his life and so on, which was very appreciated. And he did that for a few years. So he is still active, but not on TV and so on.
And then back to the golf. You came over to the States at age 15. And how did that experience sort of shape your outlook of the game of golf when you came over here?
I mean, the world was a lot smaller back then. These days, pretty much everybody travels everywhere much more often than we did back then. So for us to come to the United States was a big thing. You know, it's Like I never seen golf tournaments on TV before, even though it was majors, Masters, British Open, whatever. They were never broadcasted in Sweden. You waited for someone to tape it for you somewhere. It was US, and then they would ship it over, and then you could sit and watch it maybe 2 months later. It was on that level, and everything about the United States, you know, was so big and so amazing and so cool. So it was a big. We were here actually for I think 6 weeks and traveled. It was going to be a once in a lifetime experience. You know, we took the whole family, traveled all over US for 6 weeks, and I mean just the. Just seeing all the golf courses, you know, when they actually had grass on them, and the grass was actually green and so on, was pretty much amazing. Coming from more mud and dirt kind of golf courses, where you kind of have to hit down on the ball a lot to even get an airborne. I think guess that's why I'm take my deep divots, because I'm used to hitting it out of bad lights all the time. And back then, I remember watching golf on TV when I watched the PGA Tour. I thought just hit me that Monday. That's what I really would like to do. Come over here and play. So when I turned pro and even played Europe for the first 5 years, back in my mind, I always want to come over and play on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, and then you played your college golf in the States as well. And how was that transition from living in Europe to coming over to the States? And then as a part two of that, when did you know your game was going to be good enough during that college time that being pro or turning pro was a realistic option?
I mean, that was not the case all the time. That I always thought I was going to play the PGA Tour or become professional. It's never been like a thought, you know, that one day or so on. It more was a process. I mean, it just kind of happened. You know, I became a scratch player, and then I became a member on the Swedish national amateur team. I came over here and, you know, played for a Palm Beach college team down here, and just started noticing and realizing that a lot of players are very good, and you know, I practice harder. And when I turned pro, I actually went to tour school in the United States and made it through the first stage and second stage, and never turned up on the third stage because Volvo had just been the main sponsor, just turned him to be the main sponsor for the European Tour. And that was one of my sponsors then, and they wanted me to play the European Tour qualifier instead. So, I'm pretty much the only one, I would say, professional that made it through first stage and second stage and never showed up for the finals or the PGA Tour qualifier.
So when you turned pro in 86, did you have to play the Challenge Tour, or did you pretty much get through the Q School on the European Tour, and was that sort of your first tour to play on?
I mean, I even started on the mini tours over here in Orlando. And it's important to play tournaments as a pro. I mean, one thing, what I see a lot of times today with guys that don't make it is that they just stand on the range and hitting balls, practicing, and get kind of lulled into this little comfort zone at a home club and so on. And I pretty much knew I had to go out there and play tournaments from the get-go. So whenever I could find a tournament, it was a mini tour event up in Orlando. It was Challenge Tour events in Europe or whatever. I played those. So I played those, I would say, for one full year, mini tours and Challenge Tour. And then I missed my tour qualifier in Europe. And then I did the same thing one more year. And then I actually won the tour school in Europe. And Vijay, I think, actually finished second the same year in the tour school. So it took me, 2 years to get my card in Europe. And then it was funny. Me and Vijay played together a lot on the European Tour, then practiced a lot together and so on. And then he went over here and got his card, and I came, tried 1 year after, and also, I didn't win the tour club. I finished second, I think, in Palm Springs. So in a sense, I've been lucky with that. It was kind of a straight path. It's not like, you know, I had to struggle 10, 20 years to get my tour card. And today it's pretty tough today. I mean, there's a lot of unbelievably good players trying to get their card every year. And the process now in the U.S., when you first have to get on the web.com tour to have a chance to get on the PGA Tour, it's not easy. I'm kind of happy I've already been there and done that, actually.
How much fun was playing the European Tour in the late 80s? There had to be some great characters of guys who are still on that tour who'd had to be a lot of fun to hang out with. Is there any who was the crowd you kind of hung with?
And completely different from today. I mean, it was more like a lifestyle, I would say, in European tour in the 80s. You had a lot of funny characters, like Tony Johnston is one of them, but Mark Rowe, the list just goes on, and it was always a lot of fun every weekend. And it was, like I said, more of a lifestyle where if you made a cut or not make a cut, go out party on a Friday night was not very uncommon. And because the money was not in it the same way it is now. I remember, I think my first year out in Europe, I needed to make, I think, 4,000 pounds to keep my card, which it sounds ridiculous today when you almost need $1 million today. But it was by four, and I don't think it was that long ago, but about 4,000 pounds you needed to keep your card in Europe back then.
So there were some Friday nights where Sam Torrance was bellied up to the bar, even though he had to play Saturday morning. That was
yeah. It was a lot of guys going straight to the first tee, actually. And then also, like I said, we traveled together. It was organized, through these travel companies in London. So pretty much all the trips, all the flights, we flew together, stayed in the same hotel. So it just became a different camaraderie than it is today when everybody's more split over a lot of hotels. There are more options, there are more flights, there are more, a little bit more of everything. And back then it was more like the traveling mystery crazy tour, but it was a lot of fun.
Also on the European Tour in 92, you did have a six-hole playoff against Seve. And how was that to be in that battle? And even though he didn't come out on top, how cool of an experience was that to go up against a legend head-to-head and kind of see what happens?
I mean, I think it was very cool, like you said. And mindset was also a little bit different back then. You had more the guys like Seve or Nicklaus or Palmer. I mean, they were big. It was not like you were a little bit, ho-hum and you became best buddies straight away. I remember almost shitting myself first time I saw Seve on the range. Or he came up and, hit balls next to me. It was like, holy cow, I better focus now because Seve is, watching me. So that was a huge experience. It was my first big chance to win a tournament. And I would say I actually won it 5 times in that playoff because he was all over the place. He was duck cooking, snap slicing. I don't think he hit the green once. And he somehow managed to tie the first 5 times, and then won on the sixth playoff hole. Of course, it was not the way I wanted it to end, but it was still a great experience and very cool to have played, six-hole playoff with Seve. You see, I mean, he's one of the true legends in the game.
Did during that playoff, you're a young guy on tour trying to win for the first time. Did he sort of use his presence and did he quote unquote become Seve, where he's going to kind of try to intimidate you into it's I'm a living legend.
No, he didn't try to intimidate, but I could tell though his winning spirit and his winning mind. It's hard to explain because, like I said, I could hit it. First of all, it's a tough hole. It's a driver, 2-iron, whatever. But I remember even having like 8-footers for birdie, and he would still, after his third shot, be 40 feet away from the hole. And so, I mean, of course I'm going to win easily. And he was somehow like, he will the ball in the hole. And you go like, are you serious? No, I mean, I won that. And so you could tell that he had his passion and winning focus that not too many guys have. And that week was actually the first time I ever wore my bill flipped up as well. So that was was actually pretty amazing. I flipped it up that week just to, for the beginning was to get a suntan, but then I putted better when I had it flipped up. So that was actually the first official week I had it flipped up. And the crowd seemed to like it that week, and it was a successful week. I thought, I'm not being very superstitious, but everybody, all golfers are in a way. So I kept having it flipped up after that.
And never went back to the other way, right? I mean, that was sort of your trademark at that point forward.
No, exactly. That way came. And I didn't realize it back then that it's going to be a trademark, but I guess that's how easy it is to stand out in golf. It's pretty much a sport, you know, when you just do a little bit different and so on. Look at DeChambeau right now with all his thoughts and all his theories. And, of course, all his wins now. But he just adds a little bit special extra to your personality or your name.
Well, I don't think any golfer could take that look because that's your look at this point, right? They'd be copying you, so it's not going to
work. Yeah, like I said, it was lucky I played well in that first event. The same thing when I came out with, you know, the Jay Lindeberg clothing with the pink pants and so all that stuff, you know. If I would have been playing like crap, I think I would have had gotten a lot of shit for it.
Right.
And like when I won the Byron Nelson in Texas with pink pants, if I wouldn't have won, you know, I think I heard a lot of other comments that week weekend.
Out of your four wins on the European Tour, which one's the most special?
I would say winning at home. I mean, winning at home or your National Open is always very special. And to win the Scandinavian Masters as the first Swede to ever do it, I think it took about 23 years, 24 years for a Swede to win it. So, and I was up against Colin Montgomery in the last round. We were paired together. It was pretty much between him and I, and it was pretty much a duel the whole Sunday. And, of course, it was nerve-wracking because I had the expectations of the whole thing. Pretty much all of Sweden. And the crowds were huge that week. And to be able to pull that off in the end was very special. It's something that I will never forget when it comes to wins.
Well, also upcoming here in a few weeks, we have this small little event called the Ryder Cup coming up, and figured no one better to talk to you about this, especially being in continental Europe, and you've been there and you've done this. So is it the ultimate pressure cooker, and is the pressure different than even back nine of a major?
I would say definitely. I mean, back nine of a major, of course, is a lot of pressure. I have my chances to win a lot of majors, British Open and some others, but Ryder Cup is different because it's so hyped up. It's so, the energy is, I mean, on the level, that's hard to explain. Anyone who has never been to Ryder Cup pretty much has to go just to experience it, because they will not believe they're at the golf tournament, because it's so loud, so energetic, so pumped up, so much adrenaline, so much nerves, and you feel it, and the crowd feels it, and I would say the crowd is more like a frenzy, you know. It's not like they're just rooting a team on. They, you know, you can see it in their eyes. They are pumped up, and so are the players. And even standing on the first tee, you know, the first day, I would say most guys in the first Ryder Cup don't even remember teeing off because you're so nervous. And if you think about it in any other event, if it's a major or, you know, PGA Tour event or European Tour event or whatever, you never see anyone, you know, fist pump or high five on the first hole. I mean, it never happened. But in Ryder Cup, that's going to happen, you know, Friday morning, first hole, you make a putt, you're going to have fist pump, and it's going to be cheers louder than you ever heard before. So for me, it's the most fun, it's the most nerve-wracking, it's the most testing, you know, atmosphere you can have in golf. And like I said, for anyone who has never been, that's got to be come off your bucket list, because it's going to be so much more special than you ever expected.
And in 97, Seve was your captain. How was that experience being a first-time Ryder Cupper and then, you know, winning the Ryder Cup on your first go-around? What's sort of your best memories of that, the first one?
I mean, to have Seve as a captain in Spain, of course, and it was, first time outside, you know, UK and all that. It was some extra, you know, it was an extra feeling in the air about it. And for Seve not to play on the team was kind of weird. And he was a different captain, I have to say. He was, he really wanted to have played. And he was everywhere that week on every shot. And I wouldn't say he always gave the right advice. I mean, I remember trying to hit my third shot on 17, one of the matches, and we were tired. It was a big pin was back right, and his water in front of the green, and it was like a 75-yard shot, which I hate. And I was taking practice swing after practice swing, and when I was just about ready to go, I see Sebby coming running down the hill. And I look up, yes, what do you want? And he's screaming at me, Jesper, don't hit that in the water. And I go like, are you serious?
Like you need to hear this right now, right?
Yeah, but he cared so much about everybody or whatever they did. And, you know, I hit it to 2 feet and made birdie. So, and a lot of times he did that. I know Colin Montgomery, if you a few times, had to tell you, hey, Sebby, yeah, just walk away. I got this. Yeah, man. But Sebby pretty much wanted to hit the shot for you in every occasion. So it was very cool to win, and especially because, you know, Sebby was the captain.
Yeah, and to do it in Spain. 99 Ryder Cup, I mean, that had to be a surreal event. In one sense, I mean, you get 3.5 points. You play great. But that Sunday had to be one strange day in the history of the game of golf, I'd have to imagine.
The crowds in Boston, I mean, they're known for being very loud. And then you add on the Europeans and so on. And it was a strange week. I mean, me and Sergio came to eat, I think, a day earlier than the European team. So we used to play a practice round. And that was, you know, his first big tournament on the world scene, so to speak. I think he was only like 19 years old.
Yeah.
And so we just decided to be partners and played unbelievably well. You know, we never lost a match together. I think we holed out 3-4 times. I mean, holed out long shots, not just chip shots, putts. And the crowds were crazy. But the weird thing that was, like I said, the Boston crowd can be tough. And I remember, I think it was this, could have been first round on Saturday. We were playing against, I think it was Payne Stewart and Justin Leonard, if I don't remember wrong. I definitely know it was Payne Stewart, and we played 16, and we are 2 up. And it's a par 3, and as we're walking, you know, past the big grandstands and so on, the U.S. crowd start booing the Americans, like, boo, you guys freaking suck, you know, go home, you losers. And I go like, is this really happening? I mean, are they rooting against their own players? And I was very surprised, but then I heard, like, Boston crowds can be very rough on their players and so on if things are not going right. That's why it was so amazing on Sunday when the tide kind of shifted and the momentum shifted, and you could feel the whole place just going from being let down, you know, feeling sad about almost losing already, and turning and in the end just erupting in a climatic chaos. Even if that we lost, I mean, still look back at that as a great week. Certainly had a lot of fun. I mean, we played pretty much perfect golf, so what can you do? And it's going to be one of those weeks that's going to be remembered for that amazing finish and the putt Justin Leonard hold on 17.
And then in 2002, you kind of get your revenge from 99, and to do it for Sam Torrence, that had to be really special. He seems like he'd be such a great guy from seeing him from afar. He had to be a great captain, and what a way to end your Ryder Cup run with, you know, another victory.
Yeah, I mean, he's been one of the main characters in the Ryder Cup history, Sam Torrence. And to have him as a captain was, again, of course, special. And after lost in 99, and after the whole, being delayed 1 year because of September 11th, 2001, which is not a long story because I was in Manhattan, you know, when September 11th happened and the plane hit the buildings and so on. And then all the feelings, all the chaos around the whole world at that time to go and play at Belfry. And it was a lot, I would say, more nicer feeling atmosphere in a way for being a Ryder Cup. And Sam Torrence was a very funny guy. You know, he kept the spirits in a very friendly, funny way. Same thing with Curtis Strange. And to be able to tie Tiger, actually. I played Tiger on Sunday in the last match, and we tied our match on the 18th hole. And it's always special to win, of course. But that was, again, a little more special since we left the one and go away in 99.
When you get paired up against Tiger in that Sunday match where it's head-to-head, I mean, I'm assuming it's got to be the coolest thing ever, right? Because I'm assuming you want it. And then he has to bring out the best in you. And it has to be fun to play against him, right? Like, you want the best at that point in time to go up and see.
Well, actually, not that week. Because, you got to also remember, the Ryder Cup was postponed 1 year. So it was a lot of players on both teams that were not playing their best. And I was one of them, that kind of the last 6 months leading. Of course, you were picked almost 2 years before every year you're going to be playing at Belfry, since we laid it all the way to 2002. So I had actually played pretty poorly the 6 months leading up to that Ryder Cup. And so in a way, I did not want to have the very best come out of Tiger or have meet the very best, because actually going to bed on Saturday night, that I thought, holy cow, I could lose this 10-8 in a heartbeat, because that was pretty much when Tiger was peaking. That was when he played his best in 2000, 2001, 2002. And I actually don't know how I did it. I just remember I was fighting like crazy and somehow scrambling and making everything. And I think he was pretty frustrated in the end to not beat me. But it was more one of those scenarios or cases where I can't actually don't remember much. I was so focused just to be able to hang on, because the way I was playing, the way he was playing, he should beat me. And I remember Sam Torrance coming out a few times on the course, saying, "Oh, yes, but just hang in there. I know you're not playing your best, but just hang." And I just kind of hung in there and tied him in the end.
Yeah, so sometimes you can get done with guts too, right? You keep plugging away at it and just be...
Ryder Cup usually brings, because like also because of the atmosphere and the energy, it brings the best out of most players. You see things that the Ryder Cup guys dig very deep and get the energy they need to do amazing up and downs, hold amazing putts, hold out amazing shots. Yeah, you see stuff in the Ryder Cup that you go like, this can't really be happening. But I think it's actually it's the pumped up version of any other tournament, so it definitely brings the best out of you. But on the other hand, if you let it affect you, and it could go the other way around as well. I mean, you saw, for example, Kalkiewicz. I think he was he 5-up with 5 to go at Kiowa and let it get to him, and he lost 0-5. So it can go if you don't keep your focus on and keep confidence and keep really, keeping everything on every shot, you can let it slide away as well.
So of the three Ryder Cups you were on, who was the, say, one or two Americans that you thought were the toughest over that period of time that you played against, that you really admired their guts and their ability to get the ball in the hole under any circumstance?
Tiger, of course, is probably one of the best competitors that ever played. I mean, it seemed like he could will the ball in the hole from anywhere just by looking at it, which was a very weird experience. And guys like, Calc is probably one of the better competitors I ever met. Duval at that time, he was playing his very best as well. So he was very tough, very confident guy. Marco Mira was always a guy that was very tough. I mean, it's most guys, I have to say, it's the reason why they're on the Ryder Cup team, and that is why they're pretty tough to beat.
Let's talk Open Championship. It's two-part. First off, is it your favorite major on the regular tour? And if it is, what makes that event so special?
I would say it's a mixture of the history behind it, the understanding of the game from the crowds, and the shots needed, to win the tournament. Especially if you get, the elements of wind and so on that usually happens in the British Open or the Open. I always get yelled at over there when I say the British Open. So it's, and I would say most people would agree, the roars there are a little bit different. I don't know if because the grandstands, like, just think about the grandstands are down the 18th, so you pretty much have, I don't know how many stories they are, but they're pretty big, and you get them pretty much the whole fairway down 18, and there's a certain sound to the roars there. And I don't know, I always enjoy them. And because in that wind, on those, I would say, elements, a miss or, you know, if you get the wrong curvature of the ball, it always multiplied. So if the wind was off the right and you tried to draw it and you double crossed a little bit, it was not just like you missed it 10 yards left. You could miss it 40 yards in either direction. And I always loved to cut it into the wind when it was blown off the right, or hooking into the left to right wind and hit low and bounce it up. Or you had so many options. And kind of like Freddie Couples at Augusta, he can see every shot. It just feels good for him to maneuver the ball, hit it up on the hills, and let him feed through the hole. That's pretty much what the Open was for me. I could somehow just sense how I should get around the golf course. If I needed to putt from 120 yards, I would putt from 120 yards.
94 and 97, you were really close both times. Looking back, what's sort of your best memories of competing at that highest level and you know, having that really good run for those few years in the Open Championship and being that close? I know it's got to be bittersweet, but you also have to be very proud of the way you competed in those events.
Yeah, I mean, in 94, I mean, the coolest thing ever was then, you know, that was my second major I ever played in, and I get to play with Jack Nicklaus on Thursday, Friday, and then Tom Watson on Saturday, Sunday. So it's just that in itself was like, wow, this is the coolest week ever. Then to have a chance to win it on Sunday, actually, I think I had a three-shot lead for a while. As things turned out, when I was playing 18, I think Nick Price had made some bogeys or whatever, so I had a three-shot lead, and Tom Watson actually congratulated me when we pulled out on 18. And then all of a sudden, Nick Price made an amazing birdie on 16 and then holed the 80-footer for eagle on 17 to make it turn around pretty quickly. But even though, of course, there was a huge letdown, and actually because I actually thought I won it for a little bit, and then especially when a guy like Tom Watson congratulates you to the win, and to have it kind of disappear, I would say 20 minutes later, that was kind of surreal. And but then when I looked back at it after a few days, you know, I just so think about it. You play with Jack Nicklaus Thursday, Friday. You play with Tom Watson Saturday, Sunday. You played the very best you could, and you almost won it. I mean, who could ask for anything more than that?
Right, you had a chance on Sunday. Right, that's why you guys, I mean, a lot of it is just getting yourself in that position, correct? And the chips fall where they may, but you're right there.
Yeah, and I mean, I made 5 birdies on the back nine. I was very focused. And, you know, I told myself to just keep my head down and just go for it. You know, make more and more birdies. And I did. And I there was a talk afterwards, you know, because I didn't really know how many shots I was leading by and so on. And I went for the pin on 18 because I tried to make one more birdie. And you know, some people thought maybe I should have played safe. Then it would have been a playoff. But on the other hand, if I would have pulled it up and made birdie on 18, I would have won by one. So you never know. But making 5 birdies on the back nine in the British Open on a Sunday, I thought it was pretty special.
You had a really good run on the PGA Tour from 98 to 2001 with 5 wins. When you sort of look back at that run, what part of your game or elements of your game led to winning that often in that short of a period of time?
I think I actually had a lot of seconds as well. I think I finished second 5 times in 97 before I won 98. So I was pretty much on, you know, my game was on. And it was mostly my iron game. I knocked it close a lot of times. Well, a little bit iffy with a driver, I remember. But confidence was good. You know, I pretty much went for everything. And when my putting was half decent, it seems like I was either close to winning or our winning. So, and, you know, it was a time when I think the focus was very good. I expected myself to be up there every week. I, you know, believed I could win every week and so on. And it's usually that time of, you know, in your career where everything seems pretty easy, or not, I wouldn't say easy, but it seems like you're up there a lot. And after a while, when you're not, you can't really figure out why you're not. So it just happens. It seems like most guys peak around there, around 30, you know, they have the best years or best 4, 5, 6 years. Then you have a few players, of course, like Tiger, that can have a good 10, 15 years, but that's very rare.
Well, the last few I got for you here are just kind of quick rapid fire and whatever kind of comes to your mind. And I'm going to throw some names of some of your contemporaries from the European Tour and kind of give me your thoughts on them as a person and them as their golf game. So my that's all right. So my first one is Colin Montgomery.
Colin Montgomery, I mean, amazing player. For him to win the money list, I think it was 7 years in a row. Think about that. That's, I mean, that's very impressive. And for everybody that just kind of see him on the golf course being a little bit ticked off sometimes, he is one of the funniest guys on the Champions Tour. Very dry, hysterically funny sense of humor. And if you have a chance sometime and have a chat with him, he is a very funny guy.
Lee Westwood.
Also funny, you know, dry sense of humor kind of guy. Very impressed that he was one of the best players in the world for a long time, lost it all, and then made it all the way back again. It's not everybody can do that. And, you know, one of the guys that played, I think, the most Ryder Cup matches ever. So, a great, great guy who to have on the Ryder Cup team.
Ola Thabel.
Oh, a lot of passion. In great focus. Kind of like Severeski, you know, like being able to will the ball in the hole. Amazing focus. I've seen him, you know, almost take the pin out like Phil can do from 50, 60 yards on pitch shots when he has to make him. Amazing focus. And overall, but he's a very nice guy. Very, very good guy to be around.
My next one, I think he's going to be great for the Champions Tour because he's just getting back out there, is out there, Darren Clark.
Darren Clark, him and I, just we flew home together the other day, actually. And it was not a great trip because actually we flights were canceled, delayed, and so on. But he's also a very funny guy, you know. Older genre from European Tour. You know, they're more like the pop kind of guys, you know. Love to have a pint of beer, have a good chat, having a lot of fun after rounds. Always been like that, very chatty, very, you know, like to crack a few jokes. Just a fun guy to have him have at the night out or whatever. And an amazing player. And what he did, you know, after all he went through to go and win the Open, that's almost, you can almost make a movie about it, all that scenario, you know, with him losing his wife and all that, and they go out to win the Open. It's pretty amazing story.
And my final guy here, Henrik Stenson.
Henrik Stenson, I mean, very strong player. Also one of those guys that him and I kind of never crossed paths in the sense that we played, you know, right when he came out on European Tour, I pretty much moved over to the PGA Tour. And he was, I remember, very up-and-coming and very strong player, but completely lost it for a while. And, I mean, people just can't really understand it. The way he played the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, he pretty much could not find two fairways over for a while there. And that's when he's pretty much switched to the three-wood, and he's probably one of the best three-wood players ever right now. Dry sense of humor. Maybe that's a theme among all the players you mentioned from Europe. A
few more, and I'll get you out of here, but these are more on your career. Best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
Oh, well, best golf shot I ever hit under pressure. I mean, there's many of them. I would say one of them was, you know, actually coming over here in tour school, in Palm Springs, and I think I shot like 64 or 65 the first 2 days, and I pretty much was set to keep my card, and I got to play the easy course at tour school, and somehow you're starting messing up completely, and I remember the ninth hole I played, I hold like a four-footer for triple bogey.
Oh, God.
And to shoot a 78, I think, or 79. And that was probably the biggest putt ever right then and then because I was about to lose it all. But and then I came back, shot 67, 67, and got my card. So that, I think that was one of the biggest putts in the world. So it's not always the ones, you know, for to win or so on. You have a lot of putts are just for momentum and just to maybe not happening, just only on 18.
Three or four of a couple of the most interesting people you've ever gotten to meet because of the game of golf. Not necessarily have to be golfers, but just because of where you're at in the game and what you've accomplished, you've gotten to spend time with some of these people or met them.
Oh, boy. I mean, of course, a lot of the presidents you get to meet through golf, all the athletes, all the celebrities, period, that you meet in that Pebble Beach Pro-Am. And, I mean, it's amazing the people you meet through golf. Everybody from playing with Kevin Costner to Michael Jordan to George Bush, Clinton. Yeah, the list goes on forever, and I would never have met all these people if it wasn't through golf, because golf actually it brings a lot of people together. It's a hobby for us, it's our profession, but it's a very deep, I would say, call it almost a cultural religion, golf, that brings people together, because it's something about golf that I think is bigger than that games, because it's an almost, like I said, on a religious level, and everybody has this enormous passion for it, and we're all the same when we play golf.
My last one here for you, I'm going to ask you to put your golf commentator hat on. Ryder Cup prediction over in Paris. Which team do you like the most, and why do you think that team has the best chance of winning?
Europe has a lot of guys that are looking really good, like Rom, Molinari, guys that are up and coming. But then you have guys that are not playing their best right now, like Stenson or Sergio. I don't even know if Sergio's going to make it because he played very badly all year. And you have a lot of, guys on the American team. DeChambeau got to be on the team. He's playing the best golf of his life right now. You have, I would say, a lot of guys that probably is playing more on their peak level right now, maybe more Europeans. But then Europe having their home crowd in France, man, that's a hard one. And what I got to tell people that watch the Ryder Cup, and sometimes the numbers say that one team won by 5 points or 3 points or whatever. But I have to say, every Ryder Cup I ever watched, it's always going to go either. It can go either way on Sunday, even though it's 3, 4, 5 point difference or whatever. It's never over. And when you watch it after 9, 10 holes, you know that there's this one match, this one putt that swings it all, and then it just momentum changes. Because the Ryder Cup is all momentum. So, I think the biggest role of the captains is to get the chemistry right. That's always been my belief, that it's more important that the players that play together have a chemistry and understanding among each other than how good or how well they're playing. Hal Sutton's pairing with Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson just pretty much sums that up in a nutshell.
Well, and I think Bjorn's got a tough job. I think making those captain's picks out of the options he has, I think that's going to be difficult. Furyk, I think 3 out of 4 are guaranteed.
I agree 100%. Bjorn's picks are not that easy. Furyk's ones are a lot easier, and a lot of pretty given ones that he has to pick. It's very hard. I know Darren, I think he picked Keimer and Westwood and played them a lot. last time. Maybe, and I think that was a little bit of a mistake because they were not playing the best. And that's another thing that's very important when you get to the Ryder Cup, and that's very weak, to be honest with the captain. You know, if you're playing unbelievable, just tell him, hey, captain, play me every day. I'm here, whatever you want me to do. But also, if you're not playing your best, to tell your captain that, like, I'm not actually in the best peak shape right now. So if you want to, you know, skip a few matches for me, I'm fine with that as well. So I would say chemistry, atmosphere in the locker room, and honesty is that are the three big keys to have a successful Ryder Cup team.
It's going to be interesting. Thank you so much for your time today. Best of luck on the rest of the Champions Tour in the 2018 season, and thank you again for coming on the podcast, Jesper. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, and I'm really looking forward to that Ryder Cup. That's always a lot of fun and special.
I'm with you. Thank you so much, Jesper. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you.